Now, the lecture, did I mention last time, number two? Did I? I don't think I did I? Yes, eight, the 5 points of Calvinism. We were discussing the rise of Arminianism. We did not mention number two. If I had, I would change it now. So I'm glad I did not mention it. What I intended, yes, last time to make two, I'm going to make three. Have a brief mention of two first. But before we go into that, I want to remark this, that our course last semester was primarily concerned with the great Reformation in Germany and in Switzerland, the tremendous change that it made in Europe, and then with the way in which it was carried into England. We began seeing its effects in England and Scotland. And we noticed the beginning of the rise of the Counter-Reformation. That was the field in which we were primarily interested last semester. Now, our semester break came at just about a right time. Because this semester is, while the two are integrally form an integrated whole, yet our general emphasis this semester is on the church in the English-speaking world. We will touch upon the church in other areas. But our primary interest this semester is on the developments in the church in the English-speaking world. And this semester, we are taking situations from 1600, and we are tracing them up to the situation that we have today. And consequently, if a person did not have last semester's work, and we have a very few, and of those few, I think some are not here today, who are here this semester, not last semester. This semester makes an integrated whole, except for today's lecture. And today's lecture is really completing last semester's work. Now, of course, there will be one or two other points we touch on that round out the developments of last semester. But most of the rest of this semester will be going on from last semester, particularly in the English-speaking world. So today's lecture builds very heavily upon last semester. And today's lecture is a rounding out and completing of the developments we looked at last semester. And under those circumstances, I will want to remind you of several of the important developments of last semester, to remind you of them. But I will not take time to repeat them in case there be anyone here who was not here last semester who finds himself lost at one or two points. That is, in the resume, I'll speak a bit rapidly simply to remind you of what you've already had. And if any wasn't here last semester, I wouldn't have time to go into that thoroughly. So today will be, you might say, finishing out last semester. I don't mean that it's part of last semester's work, of course, but that these movements we looked at last semester reach a tremendous climax, after which we have to turn our attention largely away from them to the English-speaking world. And we've looked at things in the English-speaking world last semester. We go on from there after today. That is, I trust I will finish points two and three today. But point two, I'm only going to speak of very briefly. Number two is the Reformed Church in France. And when I asked you in the examination to describe the condition in the various countries at 1600, I found that there were several who did not have much idea of the chronology in connection with the development in France. And since this is a matter which is past and ended and destroyed through the Counter-Reformation, it is not tremendously important that we have this well in mind. But I'm pleased if you do. And I want, therefore, just to remind you now that the Reformed Church in France, which developed largely as a result of Calvin's work, by 1660 had become quite a strong movement, 1560, quite a strong movement in France. And then the forces of the Counter-Reformation, the Dukes of Guise and their leaders, their followers, and the people whom the Jesuits roused against the Protestants, in the years from 1560 to 1595, fought war after war to try to destroy the Protestant movement in France. But at the end of the century, the Protestant movement in France was so strong that it was easily seen that it was impossible to defeat it in a military way. In fact, in the way things developed, the line of kings had completely died out, and the man who was the military head of the Protestant forces, which had been defending themselves from annihilation during these 35 years, was next in line to be king of France. And in those last years of the 16th century, when Henry IV had nearly all of France in his hands, but could not take Paris, where the Jesuits had roused the people to such fanaticism that they were living off bits of grass and mice and anything conceivable rather than surrender to the forces of the Huguenots around them, Henry said, "What is France without Paris?" And he said, Paris is worth a mass." And so, though his mother had been one of the greatest of the Protestants of France, and his grandmother had been the sister of King Francis I of France, the protector of the early reformers, Henry of Navarre joined the Romanist Church. And so, at the end of the century, we have a former Protestant as head of the church, and in 1598, he made the Edict of Nantes, N-A-N-T-E-S. How's that? 1599, was it? Oh, it's later than 89. But it's within a few years there. I don't have the precise date here. If you say 1589 or 98 or 99, I will not count it wrong. But if you say 1699, I will count it extremely wrong. Or 1549. But Henry made this edict, and the French judicial groups in different parts of France, which were in the control of the Romans, which they called Parliament. I know this recent history, spell it just like our English word Parliament. I think it would be better if they stick to the French spelling, P-A-R-L-E-M-E-N-T. Because a Parlement in France in those days was utterly different from an English Parliament. An English Parliament was an organization where the representatives of the people met to consider affairs of importance for the nation. This the French called the Estates General. And it met very rarely in France at this time. In fact, it met once at the beginning of the next century and then not again for 150 years. But in France, they had these organizations they called Parlements, which were judicial bodies of men who held the office for a long time, small judicial bodies. Nothing at all like a parliament in the modern sense. But these organizations refused to approve of this Edict of Nantes. They said there is no reason those who deny the historic faith of France should be given privileges in France. But King Henry, by his power as king, declared, "I have become a Roman Catholic. I will be a faithful Roman Catholic. The Jesuits will be allowed to bring up my children. But my brothers, the Protestants, are to have full rights as French citizens." And so he promulgated the Edict of Nantes and declared in it that it was permanent and irrevocable. Yes? That is pretty hard to prove. You would need to read many letters and documents and so on, and it's pretty hard to judge of individuals. He certainly remained a man with tremendous interest in the welfare of his old friends. There's no question of that. But I think we should say that Henry was a humanistically inclined man with great love for all Frenchmen, regardless of their views, and he probably, I think he was undoubtedly the best king France ever had, the man who did more good for the nation than anything in all it. He was anxious to help every Frenchman in every possible way, and he thought he could help them all, including the Protestants, by himself becoming a Roman. Whether he was sincere or insincere in it, and so on, it's hard to look into the man's hearts and know the facts. Very often their words belie their facts, and some people are very voluble in talking and others don't say so much. So I have not taken the time to try to go into evidence on that. When I was ordained, I was asked the question, was the conversion of Constantine genuine? Was he sincere Christian? And I felt it right to answer that I cannot judge of the sincerity of any man. Only God and you know whether you've truly believed on Christ in your heart. Other people can only go by what you say and form a judgment from your acts, and they may be wrong. And I feel that way about individuals. We cannot judge. God knows, and we know about ourselves whether we're sincere or whether we are simply saying words that other nice people say that we like to be with. And I fear there are many people who do it. And then again, there are many people who are greatly confused in their minds and who are actually able to be used as instruments of evil who nevertheless are real Christians. And I personally like to, I say, if you truly believe this, you are a Christian. But I don't judge with any man's personal sincerity. But I'm sure there were many who felt that Henry was not a sincere, had never been a sincere Protestant. There are many who felt that way. And they may have been right, I don't know. But he certainly had inherited from his godly mother and his godly grandmother a great deal of fine character. At any rate, he had the results of good Christian teaching as far as character is concerned. And he did more for France, for its welfare, than any other king in all its history. And one thing he did was to make this edict, which gave a guarantee that the Protestants, the Huguenots, the Reformed Church of France, as it was called, that they should have liberty forever. They should never be interfered with in their religious functions. They should have equal rights to hold any position in the state with Romanists. They should, not only that, they should be assured of permanent safety from attack by being permitted to have their own garrisons. And 100 towns had small armies which ensured to the Protestants in those towns protection against any attack which might be made upon them. They had a number of fortified cities. They had some fine ports. They were, as some people have said, they became a state within a state, having the power permanently to defend themselves and having equal rights with the Romanists to have positions in the government. Henry made a Protestant his prime minister, and this Protestant, Sully, worked with Henry for the welfare of every Frenchman. And after all the devastation of the previous 40 years of wars, they did a tremendous lot in improving conditions in all the towns, building bridges, fixing up the roads, making taxes more equitable, trying to seize territories in the neighborhood that were made up of Frenchmen. And Henry does not seem to have been interested, as other kings before and since, in trying to get territories regardless of the people who were in them. Like Alsace, which is 100% German, which the French have seized repeatedly, and which they, of course, are now holding. Henry was not interested in that. He was interested in Frenchmen. His interest was his love for all his fellow people. And in 1610, a man trained by the Jesuits assassinated him. So his reign came to an end then, and the good work he did was largely dissipated. But the Reformed Church had been given all these guarantees, and they felt, we are safe for the future. However, the devil probably worked here to lead many a man in the Reformed Church who 50 years before would have been interested in going out among the other people and winning them to the Lord and telling them the truth and getting them away from the superstitions and idolatries of the that had risen in the Middle Ages. They saw the marvelous opportunities in positions in the government and for advancement in commerce and all these marvelous personal opportunities for advancement that were theirs. And so in the next 30 or 40 years, we have many prominent leaders in the government and commerce in every field of French life who are Protestants. But the Protestant church, which had grown so tremendously in the years between 1540 and 1570, it did not grow much in the next 50 or 60 years. It continued about the same for half a century. That is, it was a large church. They had four big universities with large theological departments. They had great national meetings. It was a very strong, powerful organization for the reading and study of the Word of God and the holding of Protestant churches, but it did not have a growth at all comparable to what it had had before. though many of its members obtain wealth and leadership in the government and in business. Now during these, we're looking now at the first half of the 17th century, and during this time, after Henry's death, Henry IV, he was succeeded by his son, his young son, Louis XIII, who had been trained by the Jesuits, but who was a lazy, easygoing sort of fellow without much character or ability, and his mother reigned until he became of age. She was an Italian, Marie de Medici. She governed until he came of age. If you're ever in Paris, go to the Louvre. And if you go to the Louvre, be sure and go into the room where Van Dyck has made a dozen beautiful pictures about the life of Marie de Medici. And in these thoroughly idealized and thoroughly untrue history, but very beautiful pictures. And he shows this Italian woman and how her picture was brought to Henry IV, and shows Henry IV thrilled at seeing her picture. And then she comes up to France and marries him. And then after Henry's death, shows her ruling and the wonderful peace and prosperity of the country while she rules. And then her son fights against her and takes the power away from her and takes it over himself. It tells you little about history, but it does make the characters a little real. And they're very, very beautiful pictures. Among the finest pictures idealizing a person I've ever seen, and among the least true to history. But Marie de Medici ruled for a brief time, and then Louis took over, and took the power away from his mother, however, he didn't want to bother with it himself, and so it soon came into the hands of a Roman Catholic cardinal named Richelieu, R-I-C-H-E-L-I-E-U. And Richelieu is one of the most capable and able politicians in history, and perhaps one of the least interested in religious matters. Maybe. On the other hand, maybe he was working very cleverly. We cannot say. But Richelieu set to work to fulfill two great desires. One was to make the king supreme in France. And the other was to make France supreme in Europe. Those were Richelieu's great objectives. And here, in making the king supreme in France, he ran into much difficulty from the great nobles of France, who were used to ruling their own sections of France without much interference from the central government. Richelieu ran into difficulty from them, and Richelieu found that the Protestants who had were given this edict by King Henry IV and were protected by the royal authority, gave him their support against the nobles, who, after all, were very arbitrary in their rule of their own sections and who were opposing the development of the king's power. And here's a case where they became tremendously interested in a certain political viewpoint and helped on a political development which seemed to be for their good, but which in the end resulted in their annihilation. But Richelieu had the support of the Protestants in the main while he ruled. Richelieu, however, felt that here was a state within a state. And so Richelieu began to move against the idea of the Protestants having their own armies and having their own fortifications. He said, "Why should you be a state within a state?" He said, "You're Frenchmen, all Frenchmen are protected by the government. You have every right that anyone else has in the government. You're just as safe as anybody else in every way. Nobody interferes with you. Why do you need your own armies and your own fortifications and all this?" He said, "The king guarantees you your protection. What more do you need?" And some of the Protestants objected to this, and when he tried to take their armies away from them, they rebelled. And he came with force against these. Most of them were ready to take his word for it, but a small part of the Protestants rebelled, and he attacked them and besieged one of their leading cities for several years. It was a port, and finally took it. And when he did so, he did not treat the people with cruelty. He said, You are French with every right everybody else has, but there's no reason you should have what others don't have, private armies and special fortifications. And so he gave an edict of grace, as he called it. I believe the date was 1629. It was within 3 or 4 years of that, one way or the other. I think it was that. He gave an edict of grace which repeated the guarantees of the Edict of Nantes. He said, you are guaranteed absolute freedom forever in your religion. But he said, of course, you shouldn't have a private army. Trust the government. Of course, the government will protect you. You have the Edict of Nantes. You have this edict. You're perfectly safe. And so he knocked down the fortifications of the towns he had captured. And the other Protestants mostly capitulated and said, sure, trust the government. After all, look what the government's done for us already. Look at all the peace we have, all the guarantees. Why should we try to have means of protecting ourselves? And so by the end of Richelieu's time, about early in the 1640s, when Louis XIII and Richelieu both died, the Protestants had their freedom with their religion, and they had their power to advance in the government, but they had no longer the means of defending themselves. And our first half century ends in that situation. A great, strong Protestant church, one of the greatest Protestant churches in all history, which for a period of a century maintained great strength and great religious development, and its leaders were prominent in the state. And in 1650, they're in that situation where our present period ends. Yes?
What did you say the date on that
was? I did not write down the date of that. My recollection, 1629. It wasn't far from that, anyway. Well, now, that ends our present period. So we now go on to number three, the 30 Years' War. And my remarks at the beginning of the hour apply more to the 30 Years' War than what we've just looked at, though they do also apply to that. But that part we look at later. When we get to the second half, we will see the end of the Reformed Church in France. But the 30 Years' War rounded out the situations developed in the rest of Europe. And so the 30 Years' War, small a, the situation in 1600. And when you look at the situation in 1600, there are four matters which we might particularly remind ourselves of. So first of these is the Peace of Augsburg. You remember that in 1555, the emperor established a peace with the Protestants whom he had completely conquered but been unable to subdue. And then they had been able to win their freedom again from him, and he abdicated, leaving it to his brother to sign the peace. But the peace that was worked out in 1555 guaranteed to every ruler in the empire freedom to choose between the Reformed religion, by which they meant the followers, what was believed by the followers of Martin Luther, and the teaching, the church headed by the Pope. And every ruler was free to decide, or every free city was free to decide. And whatever the ruler decided, his people had to believe. But he was not allowed to kill them for disbelief. He could permit them to migrate, but he could not kill them. He could say, well, get out. This is a Roman Catholic area, you get out. Or he could say, this is a Protestant area, you get out. He had a right to maintain his religion as the only religion permitted within his area, but he had a right to choose between the two. No other was permitted. And the Peace of Augsburg said that hereafter, if in a region a bishop or a leader becomes a Romanist leader, becomes a Protestant, he is to relinquish all church property and turn it over to the Roman Church. And that in the free cities, while the free city could determine its religion, that Roman Catholics must be permitted in the free cities. They must not be driven out of the free city of the empire. The empire, as you know, was a group of maybe 100 different political organizations loosely joined together under the leadership of the emperor and the diet. Yes, Mr. Lee?
I didn't get the business about turning over the property to the Romans. In other words, if he became a Protestant, he had to turn all the property over to the Romans, even though the country became Protestant.
Yeah, that was the, you see, as Protestantism had developed, there were a number of men who were heads of orders that held large territory, or archbishops of large territory, who had become Protestants and then had made themselves dukes or counts. And they ruled the same territory as before. And the property which formerly was used for Romanist services, they used for Protestant services. Now the people of the area said, we gave the money to build these churches. We gave the money to build these abbeys. We established this. We believe this is the true Christian religion that the Christian church has held from the start. There's no reason we should turn this property over to the holders of a false religion simply because superstition sprang up in our area and received considerable strength during a few centuries. Now we see the truth which we believe the original Christians held, and this property which we built we should use for what we think is the truth. That was their view. The Romanists said this property was given to establish Roman Catholic churches and abbeys and to be held by Roman Catholic orders. Now, if people leave the Roman church, they must give up the property. So they each could make a good, strong argument. But according to, there had been many such areas, such buildings, such churches, such controls, which had been taken over by the Protestants by 1550. The peace of 1555 said hereafter that's not to be done. Hereafter they must relinquish the property and give it over to them. Well, during the next 50 years, there were two archbishops, a dozen bishops, a number of orders, large areas which went over to Protestantism, and when they did, they paid no attention to this rule. They simply took the property with them. And this naturally made the Romanists indignant. That's one of the causes of the 30 Years' War. Now, number two, the Book of Concord. The Book of Concord. You remember that after the Peace of Augsburg, every Lutheran church was a law unto itself. And one of the Jesuits said, we will soon be able to destroy Protestantism because it has many denominations as there are Lutheran churches. Everyone is a different denomination with a different doctrine altogether, and they're fighting each other bitterly. And we can destroy them one by one. It'll be very easy for us to get control. And that was the situation which resulted in the rulers of the Protestant areas getting their leading theologians together and having them work out the formula of Concord. And in 1580, 50 years after the promulgation of the Augsburg Confession, the Book of Concord was formally established by the leaders of a great many Protestant areas, including the large area of the Duke of Saxony, which included most of what had been the two areas in the time of Luther. And these areas, mostly, and also Denmark and various other countries outside, adopted the Book of Concord, which established a definite doctrine on a number of points. They departed from Luther's strong views on predestination. They greatly watered them down. But that was more or less incidental. The big thing they were interested in was the Lord's Supper. They said, this is my body, Luther said. Person who doesn't believe this is the body of Christ is not really, we can't have fellowship with it. You remember, Luther refused to shake hands with Zwingli, said, you do not have our spirit, though they agreed on 15 and a half out of 16 points of doctrine. And when Zwingli was killed in 1531 in battle, he said it serves him right for his denial of this, which seemed to Luther so important. Luther denied strongly the Roman Catholic idea that the priest has a magical power to change the elements into the body and blood of Christ. But he said, this is my body. Therefore, when we eat it, we chew the body of Christ with our teeth. It is actually the body of Christ. And how can that be? Well, he said the body of Christ is everywhere. But especially is it here where the elements. Well, I've never known a non-Lutheran who understood exactly what they mean by that. But the Lutherans became very, very strong on that point. And they considered those who differed with them on this point as hardly Christian. And that had much to do with the loss of Poland, because in Poland, a great many of the religious leaders were following Calvin's teachings on this point. And so the Lutherans of North Germany did not feel any desire to help them. And when the Jesuits went into Poland, which was a third Protestant, including most of the leaders, and the Jesuits engaged in debates and arguments, which the local leaders were not in a position to answer properly, but the North German people could have helped them with if they had been interested. They defeated these people, at least in the eyes of the rank and file of people, and they gained more power, and then they began inciting riots against them, and finally they got a Swede in there as king, who was a strong Roman Catholic, and they made Poland almost 100% Romanist. But maybe that could have been prevented if it wasn't for this strong feeling of these followers of the Book of Concord that this is the true Christianity, and if you differ on the Lord's Supper, you're just outside the pale. Well, during those years, there were those in Germany who felt that Calvin, on this particular point, was nearer the truth. And these people had a headquarters at Heidelberg. And at Heidelberg, there had been promulgated the Confession of Heidelberg, the Heidelberg Catechism, which became one of the great Reformed standards, the Heidelberg Catechism. I didn't write down the precise date of that. It's offhand, I'd say 1567, was somewhere in that area. But anyway, the Heidelberg Catechism was one of the great Reformed standards used in many countries. And there were a number of sections of Germany which were following the teachings of Calvin, which actually agreed exactly with those of Luther, with those Luther himself personally held, except on this one point of the Lord's Supper. But there were these points with which the Lutheran sections would have no fellowship. And the Lutheran said, "You are not truly protected under the Peace of Augsburg," to these various sections with their view, which also was held in the Netherlands. Well, now there is a division, you see, among the Protestants. Now, number three, the Jesuits. The Jesuits. As we saw last semester, there was this strong-willed Spanish soldier, Ignatius Loyola, who had been crippled in battle and could no longer be a great soldier, who determined to become a great saint, but carried his military ideas into his religious aspirations. And Loyola founded the Order of the Jesuits, which was to be a military order. He called it the Company of Jesus, using the military term company. They were a military group with a leader who was absolute, and except that he had people who were spying on him who would report to a group of representatives. But aside from that, he was absolute, and he had his spies watching every member of the order. And they were trained not to develop their own religious life, though they were expected to do that, but they were a military group to advance the church with a special loyalty to the Pope. But the loyalty of the Jesuits to the Pope has never been a loyalty to any individual Pope. It has always been a loyalty to the papal organization. They follow what they think is for the welfare of the papal system, regardless of whether the particular Pope in power at the time agrees or disagrees. And there have been very few popes who could withstand the attitude of the Jesuits on most things. But in 1550, the Jesuits received authorization from the Pope to go ahead and build their order into something fairly strong. And in a brief time, in a few years, they managed carefully to recruit some of the brainiest people, some of the most able people in all the Roman Catholic countries. And they organized this group which had its specific military purpose. By any means of possible, they were to advance the church. And the Jesuits never have engaged in persecution. They always try to be very pleasant, to make everybody see what wonderful gentlemen they are. They never have permitted the church to make them leaders in any persecution. But if the Dominicans or the other leaders that are supposed to do the persecution don't, they then bring pressure against them and have them punished for their failure to carry it out. They're the force behind the persecution, but they're never the actual persecutors. It was a very cleverly worked out system of establishing an organization which under one control could have its representatives all over the world, many of them in disguise, accomplishing the purposes determined by the heads of the order. And if it wasn't for the Jesuits, one questions whether the Roman Church would even be in existence today, because Protestantism was spreading rapidly. And men like the Duke of Guise and Philip II of Spain used force to try to destroy them. They killed many of them. They burned many at the stake, all that sort of thing. But that sort of thing would never have stopped the progress of the gospel if it were not for the clever, skillful management of the Jesuits. And the Jesuits have been very skillful in these regards until within the last 20 or 30 years. Right now, it's very hard to know what their future is. But there's very good evidence that they are shot through with modernism and with disagreements of many kinds, and one just wonders what's going to come out of the present situation. But until very recently, until within the last 20 or 30 years at least, they have been a tremendous force, and they were the force, more than anything else, I believe, which resulted in this great progress of the Reformation across Europe. Not merely being stopped, but being pushed back so that more than a third, maybe half of the territory that had been completely taken over by Protestantism was taken away from the Protestants and brought under such tight control that it was impossible for anybody for two centuries even to see a Protestant book or to hear a Protestant message. But the Jesuits were people with a long viewpoint. They did not say, look at this situation, look at this Protestant force, let's get busy and destroy it immediately. Let's put an end to it at once and go out in a great, beautiful fight to win or die and result in dying. That was not their attitude. Their attitude was, we are going to work in such a way as to get results. We are going to train people who will get results. We are going to gradually extend our influence. We are going to seek above all to get control of the leaders. And the result is that though they did win Poland back, and they had considerable influence in various ways, their influence does not really become tremendous until the beginning of the 17th century. But by that time, they had exerted an influence which resulted in the first half of this century in hundreds of thousands of people being killed by the sword, and millions of people dying of starvation and of suffering of various types, and several million people in areas which had been 98% Protestant being reduced to the situation where they could never even hear a Protestant message, and the tremendous effects of this 30 years war were the result of the workings quietly, steadily over a period of 50 years in getting to leaders and getting hold of those who would eventually be in a position to bring on this great Holocaust, which came in this first half of the 17th century. But before we speak specifically about developments in the 30 years war, I'd like to mention, remind you of one other thing in the situation in 1600, and that is I will call it the Habsburgs. H-A-B-S-B-U-R-G-S. The Habsburgs. In German, a letter B after a vowel is pronounced like a P. So this is pronounced Habsburgs, but properly spelled H-A-B-S-B-U-R-G. The Habsburgs proper. These are the rulers of Spain and of Austria during the period we now look at. Now the Habsburgs, you're already familiar last semester with Emperor Charles V. Through the clever planning of his grandfather, Maximilian I, Charles V, through the marriage relations that Maximilian had worked out, Charles V became King of Spain, Duke of the Netherlands, Duke of Burgundy, which included the Netherlands, all of what is now Holland, Belgium, Northern France. Archduke of Austria and Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. He had perhaps the largest empire that any man has had since Charlemagne. And he spent his life fighting for the preservation of this empire and spent the great wealth that came from America largely for that purpose. The preservation of the empire and the preservation of a situation in which there would be one religion in the empire. And Charles V failed dismally in these projects to which he worked so hard all through his life. But when Charles V was unable to persuade the Holy Roman the electors of the Holy Roman Empire, the seven men who had the right to select the ruler of the emperor, to make his son his successor as emperor, he then suggested they do it. They take his brother, which they did, and so he was succeeded by Ferdinand I. And Ferdinand I, the younger brother of Charles V, had been Charles' representative during the previous 30 years of busy activity in many parts of Europe, particularly in Eastern Europe. He had been his brother's representative and had been very active in affairs. And originally quite a fanatical Romanist, he had mellowed tremendously during those years. He signed the Peace of Augsburg and was intending to carry it out fully. And the representative of the Pope in Vienna wrote to the Pope and said, there are only two real sincere Romanists left in Vienna, the Emperor and myself. All the rest of them are Protestants. This was how thoroughly Austria was penetrated by the teachings of Martin Luther and of John Calvin. But Ferdinand didn't live many years after his brother Charles, and his son, Maximilian II, had heard Protestant preachers, had read Protestant books, and was very much inclined to become a Protestant. And if he had, all of this territory would probably have remained Protestant to this day. But the Jesuits were able to get to him and to argue with him. They were highly trained men, and to present things to him and to succeed in winning him away from his desire to become a Protestant, but he continued in general the policies of his father of general tolerance. Well, the Jesuits did not make a big fuss about that. They set to work quietly to plan for the next generation. And so they got his sons and his nephews. And they tried, the Jesuits established the best schools in Europe, so excellent in the training they gave, that soon even the Protestant kings were sending their children to Jesuit schools because they got a better education than they could get in other schools in Europe. And they indoctrinated his successors so that you got a generation, the next generation, that was more interested in doing away with Protestantism than they were in the increase of their own power.